flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring, backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales. Visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
Good morning. It is 9:30 Wednesday, December 8th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And last week, unfortunately, that was the beginning of me getting COVID. But I feel way better and there's lots to talk about today.
Joe, glad you're feeling better. Of the three of us, I'm the only one that has not gotten COVID. So knock on wood and welcome back.
Jonathan Green, general manager from DJ Stable. And Joe, it was amazing. In the pre-show, in your absence, Bill and I were sitting there saying, man, there's just nothing to talk about. What are we going to do? We're going to try to make, you know, chicken soup out of chicken crap. How are we going to? Well, shame on us, Bill Finley, for wishing for more things to talk about, because this show is going to be chock full of a lot.
Yep. And we're ready. We're ready. It's warming up like a boxer.
Stretching.
Jumping around. Yeah. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Make plans to attend the Keeneland January Horses of All Ages sale, which has produced the likes of recent Matriarch winner Regal Glory, January 10th through the 18th. Catalog is now online at january.keeneland.com. So huge, huge, huge news this week. And it's, you know, the untimely end of Medina Spirit obviously is going to dominate this show. There's so much to talk about, but you know, just start with the fact that it's super sad for him and for everybody who cared for the horse. You know, it's never fun when a horse dies. It's extremely not fun when a horse this talented and this high profile dies, because it brings so much negative attention to the sport. And we're going to get into all of that. But I just, you know, first of all, everybody who loved or cared for Medina Spirit this whole time is definitely feeling worse than all of us right now. So I just want to say that off the top. There's a lot of implications to this. Obviously, honestly, this is like the worst possible horse that could have died in terms of the profile of horse racing and the, you know, the discussion of whether racing is going to continue to have the social license to operate. This is the worst possible horse that could have died for that cause. The other implication before I toss to the Bill, and I'm going to have a lot to say after you guys, but I wonder if this is going to affect the Naira case against Bob Baffert or any of the other cases with Bob Baffert, or, you know, organizations and regulators trying to suspend Bob Baffert. I don't know. Like, you obviously can't point to this and say this horse was drugged, therefore Medina Spirit dropped dead of a cardiac event or an apparent cardiac event. You cannot say that. You have no evidence of that, at least until the toxicology reports come back. But I just wonder, you know, circumstantially, if this makes Naira more likely to be able to ban Bob Baffert in the next couple of months or whenever that process plays out, and whether or not this emboldens the Kentucky Racing Commission to keep up with their Bob Baffert ban. Obviously, the main story is Baffert, and there's a lot to talk about in terms of how this affects the industry, but I'm going to toss it to Bill and see what he thinks.
Yeah, Joe, thanks. And there's so many different directions to go on this. Just sort of take, I guess, one thing at a time and get back to the first thing you said. You know, John, Joe, myself, other people understand the story, that it's complicated, that in no way, shape or form did this horse get drugged and it killed him or something like that. But what does the public think? And that is what is so unbelievably important right now. And look, you know, how do we explain to the public this narrative? A horse is, quote unquote, drugged, wins the Kentucky Derby, is disqualified, then mysteriously drops dead 5-6 months later. Look, and as I said, again, we know that's not really the story, but to the public, that's all they know and that's all they see. This was on the national news. It was all over every newspaper in the country. And, you know, you just wonder how many hits can racing continue to take and just go on its merry way like this. And that's what's really scary to me. I did a story in this morning's Thoroughbred Daily News, kind of gauging the reaction. The New York Post came out and said horse racing should be banned. There's 600 odd comments on the Washington Post story about Medina Spirit breaking down, the vast majority of them saying just awful things about horse racing, comparing it to cockfighting and dogfighting and things like that, that say it should be banned. Joe, you're absolutely right. You don't want to see any horse break down, but the perfect storm and I don't mean that obviously in a good way, of the most controversial horse in horse racing, then dying. I mean, you can't in your wildest imagination think like something like that is going to happen. And, you know, I don't have all the answers. I don't know what the magic bullet is, but the bottom line is, no matter what happened here, horse racing has to get better. How? I don't know. It's not going to happen overnight. But, you know, these things are adding up to the point where at some point in time, you really do have to worry about the viability of the sport.
And love him or hate him or you know, anywhere in between, Bob Baffert is the face of the industry, and he is a polarizing individual. You don't see too many people who say, I have no opinion on Bob Baffert, in the industry, at least. And so, Bill, like you said, it is a perfect storm in the sense of you couldn't have picked a worse time or a worse, you know, poster child for a horse breaking down on the racetrack than Medina Spirit. I think, Joe, you mentioned that in your preamble. But if you took the name of the horse and the name of the trainer off of the list, I don't even know if this would be getting, you know, any kind of register. I mean, we're talking about this tragedy, and it is a tragedy. Anytime any horse dies on the racetrack or dies, period, it's sickening. But what did this knock off? What are the next few stories that it replaced that we'd be talking about today? And tell me if any of them are even positive. Navarro is trying to avoid getting deported for his issues. There were multiple breakdowns at Laurel to the point where they had to close racing for at least a weekend, if not more. There's all kinds of scandals and everything going on in France, and we'll be talking about that later, about the Rossi family that had their stables raided by the police, and 15 people were indicted there. Peter Miller got fined and suspended again. Dr. Seth Fishman, who was in the Navarro Jason Service indictments, allegedly is still selling performance enhancing drugs that are banned in the industry. And oh, by the way, Heise also proposed their guidelines on the rules. But like, none of these stories are even on the table right now, because we're talking about Medina Spirit. But like, out of all those other stories, they're all negative. They're all terrible about the industry, and they all deal with people who are in the industry that are either taking advantage of the rules or, more importantly, taking advantage of the athletes that they have been entrusted to take care of. And it's just, it sickens me as an owner and as somebody who loves the game. And I know you guys love the game as much as I do. And there are so many good people and good stories to be, you know, discussed and heralded and championed. And we can't even get to them because we're so inept as an industry of constantly shooting ourselves in the foot that we lost the privilege to self-moderate and police ourselves. And we've talked about that time and time again. And personally, I am not a Bob Baffert fan. OK, I don't think that the guy necessarily does the best for his athletes. He gets the most out of his athletes, but he doesn't do what I think personally is best for his athletes. But I can't honestly sit here and say to you guys, the horse tested positive for betamethasone, you know, when Medina Spirit, you know, in the post race after he won the Kentucky Derby, and he went on the racetrack and died, and A to B equals C, and that's why the horse died. I can't honestly say that. We personally had a horse earlier in the year who was a 2-year-old that we bought for a lot of money at a 2-year-old sale. We vetted the horse out, tipped the tail, including doing a heart scan, which we don't really do that often. And a couple months later, he was breezing 3 furlongs in the racetrack, and he died of a heart attack because he burst in aorta. Now, that doesn't happen that often, but it does happen, and it does happen for natural reasons. And again, I'm not saying that Medina Spirit died of natural causes or didn't die of that, or you know, something happened to help encourage that end result. All I'm saying is that we have to wait until we get the necropsy report back, and we have to see what's going on before we can, you know, point the finger and say, yes, the fact that the horse tested positive for betamethasone was the reason why, or was not the reason why, this horse passed away. But man, guys, this is a dark day for our industry when we have to sit here and decide which of these really just negative, crappy stories we have to talk about, because they are news and they should be reported and discussed.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like I said, no one is saying, I certainly am not, that Medina Spirit died because he was full of drugs. You know, there's no evidence for that, at least yet. We got to wait for the toxicology report. But letting people like Bob Baffert, who has a proven poor safety record and drug record. The Washington Post did a story last year where his breakdowns per 1,000 starters is something like 8.3, which is the highest in California. He has way too many horses die relative to the amount of horses in his care. These are facts. Letting him train the most high-profile horses in the game, I think, is a recipe for disaster. And you know, how many more goddamn times does the sport as a whole have to take a massive PR hit for Bob Baffert? Like, at what point will enough be enough? And, you know, the sport get the picture and say, hey, Bob, you know, I'm sorry, you know, I know we're friends, but we can't keep you around anymore. You know, at least not at this level. And let's be real. If Bob Baffert was in any other sport, if he had his record in any other major sport, he'd have been banned by now. You know, it's a laughable notion that, you know, he could possibly be this valuable in this industry where, you know, even, you know, 999 out of 1,000 people in America couldn't recognize him if he walked down the street wearing an "I'm Bob Baffert" name tag. But yet the way people go to the mat for him in this business, you would think he's the most valuable person in the industry. You know, he has his tentacles in so many things and has so many friends in high places. And, you know, we didn't mention this, but Friday, his lawyer released the report from the betamethasone positive from the Derby, you know, trying to say that, yeah, it wasn't an injection, it was an ointment. Like, first of all, why is the lawyer releasing that? Like, why is that not coming from an official regulator or a vet or something? Like, how does Bob Baffert's lawyer break that news to the industry? And I think it's because people are scared of Bob Baffert and his lawyers. And there are many, many Baffert apologists in this industry still couldn't help themselves. You know, they immediately had to, you know, start writing op-eds and tweets and start waving their finger at anyone who's actually trying to discipline or regulate him. I think that tells you a lot about where we are right now. And couple that with the Peter Miller situation that John mentioned, the guy has had 5 horses die this year, multiple medication violations, and he gets to go take a 6-month vacation while still clearly owning and training horses. Just give him another maximum $5,000 fine and let's forget all of this happened. It's a joke. And like we're saying, you can't connect A to B and say Bob Baffert drugged his horse, therefore he's dead. But the longer you let people like Bob Baffert and Peter Miller, who have proven poor drug and safety records, continue to train high profile horses, the more likely I think stuff like this is going to happen. Bill?
Yeah, Joe, and I'm going to play devil's advocate here. And I think of the three of us, I'm probably the least hard on Baffert among the three of us. And, you know, I've given this a lot of thought and I don't really have an answer. But and I'm not sticking up for him here. But, you know, and I'll before we go to John, I'll say what I have to say and then give you a chance to answer here. I mean, you're talking about the most draconian punishment possible, that you're saying that's it. He's gone from the sport, just completely want him banned out now. So take away a man's livelihood. And, you know, he's not good for the game. I'm not going to even pretend that. That's obviously not. But, you know, you yourself said the betamethasone doesn't mean the horse was drugged and it has nothing to do with him breaking down and dying. Are you willing to give him any benefit of the doubt that, you know, maybe it's nothing more than he's very sloppy and unlucky? And that, again, there is none of these violations have anything to do with performance enhancing drugs. And again, I want to preface this. I'm not sticking up for him. I'm just saying that I'm more conflicted about this than obviously you are. Service Navarro, the easiest thing in the world. Put him in jail, throw away the key, lock them up, send the guy back to Panama and just get out of this game forever. It's a lot more complicated with this guy. And I honestly say, at the end of the day, I don't know what the right answer is, but I don't think I would advocate for him being completely banned from the sport.
I mean, that's fine. And that's, you're right. But the thing is, we're talking about a totality of offenses here over decades. We're not talking about one or two things in the past year. And we're talking about the in 2011 to 2013 supposedly mixing thyroxine into the horse's feed and 7 horses ultimately dropped dead. And California eventually swept that under the rug and he didn't, you know, face any sanctions or any punishments from that. From the, you know, it's just been going on year after year over time. to the point where I, you know, yeah, it's hard to say, well, Medina Spirit dropped dead, therefore you're banned for life. The point is that this should have been taken care of and nipped in the bud a long time ago. And if you have to come in and do a makeup call later on, then so be it. And the, my main point is that the reason that this hasn't happened all this time is because he has so many friends in high places and because he has so many people in the industry sticking up for him and going to bat for him, like we saw in the op-ed that aged so well over the weekend. There are just so many people in racing, so many decision makers, so many influential people who will go to the mat for Bob Baffert as if he's the most important person in the industry. And that's why he hasn't been banned or meaningfully sanctioned all this time. So, yeah, it's a hard thing to say this thing happened, so therefore you should be banned, Bob Baffert. But over time, over decades now, he's gotten away with breaking and skirting the rules. And there's nothing has come of it. Nothing. Like he hasn't been sat down for 30 days, 6 months, a year. So if you have to come in and do and, you know, kind of make up for all of the stuff that's been let slide over the years, it's not about this one incident, Bill. It's about
the
totality of his record and the fact that we all have to take the hit now for this. You know, the entire industry is in peril in large part in the past year, at least, because of Bob Baffert. Like that's just a fact. And that's something that I wish people in the industry would take more heart with too. Like, this is something that's affecting all of us and our ability to make a living in this industry going forward. And I don't care how friendly you are with Bob Baffert, you got to think about more than just you and Bob Baffert when it comes to this kind of stuff. Sorry. Right.
And I know we talk a lot of baseball here, you know, amongst ourselves and also on the show. And you know, there's always that argument for the Hall of Fame of was the person like Sandy Koufax, where they had a phenomenal record for a short period of time. Were they really good over a long stretch of period of time and it's a no-brainer, or were they a compiler? And I think in this situation, what I'm saying, and I think what you guys are saying also, is that Bob Baffert is, you know, his sentence is going to be more predicated on what his body of work has been based on history, what his compiling has been over time. And it's not that Medina Spirit tested positive for, you know, for whatever, for betamethasone. And it was an ointment versus an injection. Who cares? It didn't really affect, in my opinion, didn't affect the fact that the horse ran well and won the Derby because of the ointment or because of however it got the betamethasone. The same as I don't think that, personally, I don't think that if the horse was on a history of steroids or a series of steroids or any illegal performance enhancing drugs, that's why it dropped dead after a breeze the other day on the racetrack. It's just all of these years and incidents and time over time of problems and innuendos and more importantly, deaths on the racetrack. And it's all those little things added up that are compiling that are making such an outcry right now for people to say enough is enough. This guy has to be addressed. And it's the white elephant in the room. We can't sit here and say, you know, definitively whether or not this one instance was the reason why he should have some kind of a sentence. It's all these other things over time. And Joe, let me just take a minute, because the Washington Post information and chart has been very, very good. It's been very illuminating in my estimation, as far as trainers and whether or not they should be held accountable for deaths and career-ending injuries on the racetrack. I was doing some research and saw that the National Thoroughbred Welfare Organization, which is a nonprofit out of Kentucky, and they tweaked the numbers a little bit, and they basically compiled the first publicly available nationwide collection of fatalities, but they excluded illness, disease, and accidental deaths. So if a horse like ran into another horse and died or flipped over and hit its head and died, they took that out of the equation. And what it does is it basically just focuses on catastrophic breakdowns and deaths, similar to what happened with Medina Spirit. Okay. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't an illness like the horse colicked or anything like that or foundered. It was the horse, you know, maybe ruptured an aorta on the racetrack. And they did the analysis from 2018. So they took all of 18 starters, all of 19, 20, and 21, and they compiled those, you know, almost 4 years worth of fatalities and information. And Patty, hopefully you can show this on the screen, but they came up with what I'm terming is a fatality factor. They just call it a percentage. And the national average for horses that die because of breakdowns is 0.89%, so less than 1%. And I know that's too much. We're not saying that that's a passable grade, but just stick with me for a second. It's 0.89%. And when you go down the numbers, you look at it and you say, well, where's Bob Baffert on this? He's at 1.13%. So slightly higher than the average. Not as much as I think in the Washington Post, which I think, you know, by excluding those other issues, maybe takes out the, Bill, you use it, the sloppiness quotient of the situation. But when you look down this when you look down this list, you guys are smart enough and our audience is smart enough to look down the list and go through and say, well, some of these trainers, I'm not surprised they have a higher fatality factor. And some of them, I'm not surprised, have a lower fatality factor. And guys, when I tell you that, like, you know, Wesley Ward and Mark Cassie and Graham Motion and Shug McGahee, amongst many others, are so far below the fatality factor, you wouldn't be surprised. But when you go through this list, and I'm not going to name names on here, but you guys can go through the list and see the trainers that are on here, and I would guarantee you that you will not be surprised. Some of the trainers that are above the fatality, average fatality factor. And I think that's something that calls into question also with our industry, where it's like between the Washington Post story and these set of circumstances of these facts in this database, you have to sit here and say there are guys that and women that just aren't doing right by the horse. They're not doing right by the horses that are under their charge, and they need to be recognized and admonished for that.
Yeah, no, I mean, and yeah, those stats are always pretty revealing, I think, honestly, because you can see day to day, you know, whose horses you feel like are in more danger, you know, or than other trainers. I want to go back to the public reaction thing, because Bill mentioned his story in today's TGN about the public outcry, the mainstream media and the general public reacting to this news. And it ain't good. And it's, you know, the nature of these stories are such that you're going to get a lot of negative comments on it. But Bill was saying that you get like, there were like 160, you know, anti-racing comments and maybe one pro-racing comment on the New York Times story. And I just think about how people in the industry, I think a lot of people who I'm talking about that defend Bob Baffert all the way are just, they're so ignorant of this. And you know, there's so many industry insiders that I think are so insulated by the sport that they don't realize what it looks like to everybody else. And that's why I think it's valuable to have stories like Bill did, where you can get the pulse of the public, because the public is fed up and they should be. Honestly, like, I'm tired of defending it. I'm a passionate, diehard racing fan and supporter, lifer, and I'm tired of defending this shit. And I know that, and I know that people in racing are tired of defending it, but it's just, there's just this kind of reactionary, you know, oh, well, those people don't know what they're talking about. Like, we shouldn't let them affect what we do in racing. Yeah, actually, we should. And I think about PETA a lot. And, you know, there was this in the TDN story about the Medina Spirit's death the other day, there was a little bit editorializing thing where it was like, predictably, PETA released a statement, you know, lashing out at the sport, yeah, and calling for Baffert to be banned. We mean, like, predictably, they should be releasing statements. And let me read you the statement, and you tell me if you think that this is an unreasonable statement. Quote, "It's premature to say that Medina Spirit died of a heart attack or what the true cause of his fatal collapse was, given that many of trainer Bob Baffert's horses have suddenly dropped dead. Seven of Baffert's horses died mysteriously during a 16-month period that was suspiciously linked to his reckless and routine habit of administering the powerful hormone thyroxine to horses without thyroid conditions. Baffert has continued to be embroiled in drug controversies since then, including when Medina Spirit tested positive for drugs in the Kentucky Derby. All of Medina Spirit's veterinary records must be seized and a thorough investigation must be conducted. Baffert's attorneys must not be allowed to control the narrative. PETA urges Santa Anita and Del Mar officials to bar Baffert pending the outcome of an investigation and a necropsy." You have a problem with that? Was that eminently unreasonable? Did they say that the sport should be nuked and, you know, nobody should ever be allowed to race a horse again? No. Everything they said about Bob Baffert was factual. Sorry that you don't like the facts. I mean, it wasn't, if you have a problem with what they wrote, honestly, like, maybe you just can't handle the truth and maybe you're just killing the messenger now. And it's just, when you dismiss PETA and say, like, well, predictably, PETA said this, you're acting as if they don't ever raise points or speak truths, and they have a huge audience. So it's insane to dismiss them no matter what they say, but just maybe when they call you out on your bullshit, it would be a time to take accountability and say, hey, our industry isn't perfect, but here are the steps we're taking every day to make racing safer and more drug-free. Mention HISA, do some positive, proactive goddamn PR for once, instead of just whining about how PETA's being mean to you after another horse death. And there's just so much of that in this industry that just is just reflexively dismissive of everybody who's not in the business and has a criticism of the way we run our sport, as if it's not completely warranted to have those criticisms. And as if we don't have those conversations behind closed doors anyway in the sport about how we're going to manage the latest PR crisis. I think they're just, you know, that's why we ended up talking about this stuff for like half hour, 40 minutes, because it's not about Bob Baffert and Medina's spirit. This is a symptom of the sport's ineptitude and inability to get its house in order, and this whiny, you know, reaction every time someone calls us out on our bullshit. And I'm sick of it. And I'm tired of people. I don't know. It's just really rubbed me the wrong way. The way people were wagging their finger about that Medina spirit, you know, drug result on Friday. That's just like, oh, well, guess Bob Baffert's all clean now. Don't have to do anything. No regulation, no sanctions, no punishment necessary. Told y'all that after decades, you know, Bob Baffert is a friend of mine, therefore he should stick around in the industry. That to me is a big problem, is the attitude of so many industry insiders who are going to have to be dragged kicking and screaming into the future.
Joe, I completely agree. And that was very well said, by the way. And, you know, I'll add to that. So a couple of weeks ago, I wrote a story about two state legislators in New York looking to take all the slot money away from NYRA. And last year it was the governor of Pennsylvania. And every time something like this happens, I mean, nobody thinks this is going to occur in either instance, but it makes it easier and it makes their case stronger. And you know what? I bet you there's some politicians in California right now that are, you know, thinking, you know, maybe is it time to introduce a bill to ban horse racing in California. And people that I think a lot of people don't think this will ever happen. And it's not going to happen tomorrow or the next day, or probably, and it may not ever happen, but you have to be very scared of this. It is a realistic threat. And look, you know, 15 years ago, if I suggested that the circus would no longer exist, it would have been laughable to think about something like that. And you know what? I kind of off the left field with this, but I'm going to defend myself that I'm the one guy that's anti-whipping among this. And the reason why, obviously whipping is nowhere near as serious, not even a million miles as serious as what goes on with Medina Spirit. But by whipping the horses, we give our critics one more round of ammunition to go after the sport, which I think is completely unnecessary, as Monmouth Park proved, that racing can be held fine without whipping. Don't give me any crap about the Haskell and that horse wouldn't have fought. That's nonsense. It had nothing to do with anything. So, you know, at the end of the day, Joe, I would agree with you. You know, stop making excuses, get the job done right. And maybe you're right. You know, what are we going to do? Again, I don't agree with you, but, you know, if you say that, and I don't know how it would be done because there's no national body, but, you know, every racetrack in the country would have to do what Churchill Downs did and get together and say, Bob, you can't run here anymore. You know, if that's what it takes, maybe you're right, Joe.
Yeah. And just to follow up on your point is that I think you're right that I don't think a lot of people will realize in racing how easily this could all go away. You know, it really drove home when I read Bill's story with the public reaction. I just think people don't realize, like, all your stallion money, all the purses, all the crazy sales numbers, that could all be gone. Poof. Because nobody, like, really cares about anything except, you know, protecting their friends and their piece of the pie. But the public is fed up. And I'm sure you guys know that meme of the dog sitting in the kitchen with the fire going on around him. And he's saying, this is fine. That's what I think a lot of people in racing are right now, man. Just a lot of people watching the house burn down around them and thinking, well, I'm making my money. You know, it's all good on this end. So And I just think there's no appetite in racing to rid the sport of its albatrosses, which is unfortunate because there are some good stories. You know, Handle is up. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. You know, reform is hopefully finally on the docket. But you got to be all in on that. You can't just be like, well, you know, yeah, I'm for reform and I'm for, you know, uniform rules and I'm for HISA, but this guy who's had this, you know, 30-year checkered drug pass, who has these high profile horses who either test positive for drugs or drop dead, he's too valuable. He's too good of a friend of mine. So we're going to keep him and have him train our most famous horses and just cross our fingers and hope nothing bad happens. You got to be all in. And if it means leaving some of your friends behind, you got to do it because the sport is on the precipice right now. And it has been for a little bit. And if you don't see that, you need to talk to some people outside of your little circle. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. The catalog for the Keeneland January Horses of All Ages sale is now available online. Keeneland has cataloged over 1,500 horses from broodmare and broodmare prospects to yearlings, horses of racing age, stallions and stallion prospects. The four sessions of the sale will all begin at 10 a.m. Book one will be January 10th and 11th. Book two will be January 12th and 13th. It's a chance to get yearlings from short yearlings from stallions whose first weanlings were popular this fall with Audible, Catalina Cruiser, Matoli, Omaha Beach, Vino Rosso, all represented in the Keeneland January sale. We'll definitely get involved. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
Start the new year strong at the Keeneland January Horses of All Ages sale. Make the most of your 2022. With a new year comes new, exciting opportunities at Keeneland. Be there at the first sale of the year, beginning January 10th.
Spitestown. Munnings. Echo Town.
It's Echo Town for Joe Talamo and Echo Town raced away.
And Echo Town is drawing away in the stretch. Echo Town wins the Allen Turkin Stakes.
A sire line so prolific, it repeats itself. Echo Town.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. A huge weekend for Uncle Mo. Had three juvenile winners on Friday, including the Wait a While winner, Leah Marina, for Christoph Clement at Gulfstream. She looked very good. And on Saturday, Mo Donegal won the Grade 2 Remsen. We're going to talk about that in a little bit for various reasons. Uncle Mo has now sired 10 juvenile graded stakes winners from his first seven crops. And Caravaggio, who we mentioned before, is represented by his 25th winner from his first crop on Friday with Tiberflow, breaking his maiden in England. Caravaggio, now the sire of eight stakes performers, including great Group 1 winner Tenebrism. And taking a look at the TDN first crop North American sire list, Ashford sires are all at the top of the earnings list. Practical Joke, second. Classic Empire, fourth. Caravaggio, fifth. And Cupid, seventh. So definitely a lot of power packed into that Ashford roster. And good to see Cupid continuing to come on. Caravaggio, very, very exciting. Really getting excited to see a lot more of his horses in America now that he's come over. So we're definitely looking forward to that.
I feel like Cupid is quickly becoming a fan favorite, not only of ours, but of our listeners. I'm seeing more and more tweets about his foals and you know, where they're running and how they're winning and how good they look. And it's just a phenomenon because the horse stands for $5,000. I mean, which
should make him like the new mascot of the show after Harvey's Little Goyle.
We really, really, you know, and I think we might have to. I think we might have to start doing Cupid like you know, Joe usually does for King Cupid. You know, there's a Cupid grad, you know, on tap because they're running, Joe, they're running all over the freaking place. I mean, it's not just like they're only running, you know, well in Canada where he won had a couple of great stake winners. They're running all over the country. So I'm really excited to see how this son of Tappa continues to develop.
So I thought this was going to be our top story before Monday morning. There was a lot of outcry and a lot of outrage about this. I read Ortiz Jr. on Friday almost, you know, put a young jockey into the rail. And there was a lot of backlash about it because he kind of has developed a reputation for being a little bit of a dangerous and careless rider, which is unfortunate because he's such a great rider and he's one of the best we have in terms of talent. But this is, I think, starting to kind of sully his legacy a little bit. And Irad has a lot of fans out there. He also has a lot of detractors. But this is the kind of thing that I think, you know, most people should agree that that has no business in the game and is extremely dangerous. I think we're going to show the footage right now. If we can show the head on from Friday's eighth race at Aqueduct, Irad is on the, he's on the lead and he's trying to come over to the rail. Now, if you watch it and you time it, to me, he comes over eight paths in 8 seconds. So that's one path per second. And he does not look over to see who's inside of him until he makes contact with the horse. The horse behind him checks. The jockey falls off. It was Omar Hernandez Moreno, who was a 7-pound bug rider in New York. He falls off. Thankfully, he was okay. You just, you know, you can see him kind of take a tumble and then go under the rail for safety. So glad he was okay. But it was extremely reckless. It was very damning to watch that head on. You know, you couldn't really tell from the pan how much he interfered. But that I thought was the textbook definition of reckless and careless riding. And I think what made it worse, and we can show this too, was that even after all of the outcry, and they weren't supposed to, they couldn't suspend him before the cigar mile card. Like logistically, you wouldn't be able to do that. But he came back on the cigar mile card, and if we can show the head on of the Remsen with Mo Donegal and the Chad Brown horse to his inside, I forget the horse's name, Zandon, I think was the name. Yeah, and you can see Irad coming down the stretch, leaning off his horse. And basically leaning so far that he kind of hits the horse to his inside in the face with his horse's rein and made it very, very tight on Johnny. And the Irad's horse won by a nose. They did look at it. The stewards looked at it. They decided not to disqualify him. I think that probably was not the right call. I don't know that it was a slam dunk DQ, but it was a situation where the horse probably should have been disqualified. And I think that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way that, you know, the less than a day after he could have killed this bug rider in New York, he's basically out there doing the exact same thing. And that speaks to a lack of mental discipline. And I don't want to go too strong here, but you know, when you do stuff like that regularly, it's borderline sociopathic, honestly, because it's such a dangerous sport. And we've seen Paco do this. We've seen Paco play pinball all the time with other riders and not take their safety into account. If you're doing this over and over again, and especially the day after there was so much outcry because you really could have hurt this other rider and this other horse, I think that's a problem that, you know, is not easily fixed. Now, the Naira stewards did do a good job. They suspended him 30 days, which is not something you see a lot of jockeys get, and especially for a high-profile jockey like him. You know, there's not really anything going on in the next 30 days, so it's probably a good time, relatively speaking, to get a 30-day suspension. But I thought that was the least they could have done. I'm glad they did it, and we'll see if he changes his behavior going forward, because a lot of people are saying that if he doesn't, he's going to end up killing somebody, and I can't say I disagree. Bill, what do you think?
Yeah, Joe, first of all, a couple points. I disagree with you or to the degree of the Remsen. I can't believe they didn't take him down. I, you know, everybody loves to bash the stewards, but, you know, the horse wins by a nose and he's, you know, all over the other horse and, you know, literally like his elbow and the horse's face and that sort of thing. I mean, the problem going into the Friday card where he dropped the apprentice and was that, there again, you talk about with Baffert deterrence. Where were the deterrence? I'm sure he's gotten along the way, you know, the 3 and 5 day suspensions, but you know, when does the hammer come down and you say, okay, this is going to stop right now? And if not, you know, we're going to give you 30 days and the next time it's going to be 60. And then after that, it's going to be 6 months. I know Ray Pollock in his coverage, I reference a situation where Eddie Arcaro got a year suspension for something like this. So,
and he said it made him change his behavior.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. The, you know, giving him the 30 days absolutely was the right message. Now let's see if he changes and does anything. And the fact that he couldn't go one day without getting into trouble again does tell you something about it. And, you know, back to the ride, what was he even thinking? You know, it's fine to get to the rail, but, you know, he acted as if like there were no other horses behind him. You know, the very definition of reckless and careless, like he didn't even have any regard for the other horses in the race, the other riders or anything like that. He's a great rider. He's a young rider. Let's see if he changes. And if not, you know, again, next time, some people say 30 wasn't enough. I'm fine with 30. But then, you know, next time make it 6 months. You're going to have to do that, or else, like you said, you know, God forbid it never happens, but somebody is going to get very seriously hurt here.
I'm actually glad that Naira came in and made a definitive statement by giving him 30 days, which is a lot, which is a lot of days. Granted, you can't time it with the calendar. I get it. You know, most of this time, you know, there's not going to be a lot of live racing over that period of time. Don't worry about that part. They came down with a 30-day suspension, and they came down with an immediate suspension. They didn't kick it down the road. They didn't say, well, we got to wait and see. You know, they recognized that they needed to do something. Naira needed to do something immediate and dramatic in order to get this kid to take notice. And look, Irad has won so many big races in his career, and especially over the past couple of years, you know, nationwide, if not, you know, focused primarily in New York. He is one of the top riders in the country. None of us can argue with that. Statistics show that he is a phenomenal talent. I think the problem right now is that he's a little immature mentally, and, you know, he's going into each race with road rage. He is going into each race with the idea that I'm going to savage anybody, as opposed to I'm going to ride my horse to the best of my ability and get this horse to the finish line first. And I don't remember, guys, seeing this, you know, verbatim in a daily racing form review of the race, the result of the race. But let me just read to you what they said about his ride on the winner of the Remsen. Basically, it was, you know, bump of the rival start, blah, 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 blah. Moved in closer to the run up under a right-handed crop at the 16th pole, had the rider, meaning Irad, put the crop away and throw repeated exaggerated crosses with the left rein near the face of the runner up and narrowly prevail. Now, I know we all kind of touched upon that there was malice involved, and it was, you know, it was definitely something that he knew he was going to do. It was almost premeditated that he was going to intimidate the horse on the rail. If he got to that point, so much so that he went from, you know, like Joe, like you said, the 6-7 path all the way to the rail with complete disregard of who else was there. Now, luckily they were 10 lengths up on the rest of the field, but it was those two horses going down this stretch. And what if Zandon went down? What if the horse went down and had to, and we're not talking so much about what goes on with Medina Spirit. We're talking about the fact that, you know, that Zandon broke down because of the absolute malice involved and recklessness of a rider. It wasn't because of anything the horse did. It was because of something that another jockey did on a different mount. It'd be a completely different focal point and discussion for us today. Thankfully, it didn't happen. Now, should he have been taken down? Yeah, I think we can all make an argument that Modonico should have been taken down because not because of what the horse did, but because of what Irad Ortiz did. And look, young horses make mistakes and do things that are goofy, especially young colts. And Modonico, this is only his third start. So would I be surprised if, you know, a big Uncle Mo like he is was, you know, was dragging Irad to that point in time in the racetrack? And that's why the horse, you know, almost took down the other one. Yeah, I would say I could see that happening in an early 2-year-old's career. But it had nothing to do with the horse. It had everything to do with the rider of the horse, in this case, Irad Ortiz. And, you know, we should be thankful that nothing else happened to the jockey the day before and to the horse or the horses in that race, because it would have a completely different, you know, comment section, a completely different focal point on it today. I'm just glad, again, if I can recap, that Naira took this into their own hands and said, we are not going to stand for this. We don't want this to be, you know, the image of our racing standards here. We are going to give a 30-day suspension, and we are going to make an immediate end of story next race.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to Bill's point that, you know, if this happens again, if this kind of thing happens again, it needs to be 3 months or 6 months. You know, it just, this should be a starting point in terms of, hey, we're giving you this chance right here to change your behavior. You keep doing this, you're going to get 6 months. You're going to get a year. I don't care how big of a name you are. We are not going to tolerate this. And hopefully that this is the start of that and people getting tough with Irad, because, you know, like Bill was saying, and it relates back to the Bob Baffert thing a little bit, is that, you know, as is the case in so many racing issues, there's someone who's like very high profile, has got a lot of clout, and who repeatedly acts irresponsibly and not in the best interest of people who are not him, But there's no deterrent to his behavior. So he doesn't feel any need to change. And hopefully he will with this suspension, then, you know, potentially a longer suspension in the future if he does this. You know, there's some people on racing Twitter who were saying, you know, Arad was trying to do this and put the kid over the rail. That doesn't make any sense to me. He's trying to injure a 7-pound bug boy to win a $16,000 claimer on a Friday at Aqueduct. I don't think that that's the case. It's more that he doesn't care. And, you know, effectively, that's just as bad as trying to injure people when stuff like this happens. And I think the other rider's safety doesn't even really cross his mind. And that's not much better than trying to hurt people. And like John says, I think road rage, that's pretty apt. You know, we've talked about this before. We've seen Irad yell at people on the track and the winner's circle. We saw him punch Paco Lopez in the face in front of everybody. And I think, you know, he does have a little bit of an anger management issue. And, you know, it's unfortunate because he's such a great rider and, you know, he's brilliant to watch. You know, tactically, he's amazing, amazing talent. But this is the kind of thing that cannot be tolerated. And it has been for a long time. So it's good to see the Naira stewards step in, give him the 30 days. And I would love to see him get his act together because it's a stain on his legacy to ride like this. And I hope he realizes that. And I hope he has people in his life that can, you know, that can get that through to him that, you know, you're great and all, but people are going to hate your guts. And there's a chance that someone might want to take a shot at you eventually if you keep trying to do this. So hopefully he changes his behavior, but we're going to see. We'll have to see. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV, the XBTV Workout of the Week, Reader's Cup Philly and Mare Sprint Champion CC, back on the track, working 4 furlongs and 48-4 at Santa Anita on Saturday. You can probably see that right now as I'm talking. Possibly going to the Santa Monica, I would think, is a grade two spot that she could end up in. You know, She's gonna be on the podium at least for Philly and Mare Sprint Champion. She's not gonna win. Not gonna win. Okay, John. I'm not dissing Gamine here. Look at that face. He was ready to jump all over me. I'm not saying she's gonna win, but she did beat Gamine when it mattered most. So she's gonna be nominated, homebred for Bo Hirsch. So very, very nice horse. And obviously, if you want to see her continue to train up, you can go to xbtv.com, check out all of the workouts. Like I said, with the Malibu coming up too, we had Flightline working last week. Definitely looks very good. So you check in on all the Malibu contenders, all the Pegasus contenders. I saw Nick's Go got back on the work tab recently, and we're obviously looking forward to seeing him in the Pegasus. So if you want to check out any of those horses as they prep for these big races, xbtv.com is your source. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So yesterday, Bill and I sat down with Clint Bentley, who's the director of the upcoming film Jockey, which releases December 29th in New York and LA. Let's hear from Clint.
So we're thrilled to be joined right now by the director of the upcoming movie Jockey, which comes out December 29th in New York and LA, Clint Bentley. Thanks for coming on with us, man.
Thank you guys for having me. It's good to see you.
Great to talk to you as well. So you have a little bit of a racing background. So I wanted to start with that and maybe what that racing background, how that led to you creating this film.
Yeah, my dad was a jockey. And so I grew up in the barns and I grew up behind the racetrack and, As anybody in the racing world knows, there's quite a few kids back there sometimes. And it was only when I became a filmmaker that I realized that I hadn't really seen a racing movie that told the story of a jockey and felt like I think a lot of these working class tracks feel back there. And so I wanted to really focus on that. Of it's not the Kentucky Derby. It's not the Preakness. It's not the thing that everybody watches. It's the circuit that a lot of people find themselves on.
And sorry, Bill, I just wanted to follow. Can you just expound on what your experience was growing up? Like what tracks, what did you get used to growing up?
I got used to, we lived in Florida and so we were at a lot of South Florida tracks. But then we were also all over the country, traveling with my dad out in Texas and Louisiana. My sister was born in Oklahoma City because my dad was racing at Remington at the time. And so just being on that circuit, I mean, some of my earliest memories are being babysat by the trainers while my dad is exercising horses in the morning. and then helping them feed up and helping clean stalls and all of that. I was doing my fair share of work once I got a little older. But then also just, yeah, hanging out by the starting gates, oddly enough, as a kid. And so, yeah, a lot of my earliest memories are feel like they come from a racetrack.
Clint, thanks for joining us. And the horse racing movies we're used to usually are uplifting, Disney-esque, like Secretariat. Seabiscuit doesn't quite fall into that category, but it also was a story, you know, heartwarming story of a horse succeeding at the highest level against all odds. What made you want to tell this story versus, you know, the glory of someone winning the Triple Crown?
One, I feel like we had seen that, to your point. You know, we've seen it a few times. And then two, I just, my dad had a lot of success in his career and had a nice career and got a lot of joy from it. But also, like, he didn't, you know, his career didn't go that way. And I think most jockeys, their career doesn't go that way. They don't end up at the Triple Crown. You know, they maybe don't even end up winning the Futurities. And so, I really wanted to just show that side of it, but then also, you know, within that, I didn't see that as a bad thing. I didn't see it as like, oh, you don't get to the Triple Crown, and so therefore you failed. It's like, you can have a very successful career outside of that. And also the fact that, jockeys and trainers, their joy comes from, the racing itself. And yes, they want to win, but also it's not about that. That 1 minute of a race or 2 minutes of a race only encompasses a small part of their life. And so that was really what I wanted to show. And the winning and the losing is kind of circumstantial outside of that, you know?
Right. I mean, it's a lifestyle, and it's all encompassing, which I think is something that you have, especially from the clips that you have really shown in this movie. But I wanted to ask about what kind of research and kind of background that Clifton did, because Clifton's performance is really getting a lot of buzz here. And it just seems very believable as a jockey, kind of maybe on his last legs. What did he do? Did he hang out with the racetrack? Did he hang out with other jockeys? What kind of research went into this character?
Yeah, he really went deep. He, you know, my co-writer Greg and I, we set him up with a lot of jockeys. And he just really like ate it all up. He learned everything that he could from talking to them. But then also once we got out of we went early to Turf Paradise where we shot, and he just spent every waking minute just hanging out with the jockeys and learning the little, like, physical things that they do, so that he could sell that not only in terms of saying the right words, but also having the right mannerisms. And then on top of that, he lost a lot of weight. And really like got that sunken look, that gaunt look that you need as a jockey in the face, to really sell that. But yeah, he went deep.
I'm sorry.
Sorry. No, yeah. Go for it.
On that same topic, a lot of these jockeys, wouldn't be familiar to the average moviegoer, but to horse racing fans, guys like Scott Stevens and some of the other Turf Paradise regulars, they were involved in the movie. A lot of them had small parts. And then you had the one jockey, Cormier, had a pretty big part as Leo. How did you decide where to put the real people of Turf Paradise into the movie versus a professional actor?
Yeah, that's a good question. And something I'm very proud that we were able to do is incorporate members of the horse racing community into the movie. But it was just, that was by design from the beginning of just, you know, the very dramatically heavy roles like Jackson and like Ruth and Gabriel were going to be actors. And then everybody else, we were just going to find people and tailor roles to those people. And so all the supporting roles were always going to be people from that, from the world of horse racing. And then it was really just about finding somebody who is just a very interesting person and tailoring a role to them, like with Logan Cormier, who does such a beautiful job as Leo. That role was written much smaller than that. And we just found out very quickly that Logan's a great actor and just really expanded it for him. And there's so many stories like that.
Right. I mean, that's kind of leads into my next question, which is, what do you want people to know? People who are coming into this, who are novices in racing or don't know anything about it, what do you want them to take away from this film as someone who has a background in racing, who has that kind of intimate connection to it that most people don't have, you know, good, bad, in between? What do you want people to take from the film?
I think the thing that I'm glad that it's coming across, one just very on a surface level, it's that I would talk to friends and tell them that my dad was a jockey before making this movie. And even if they knew, even if they'd been to a horse race, they would say, "What's a jockey?" And they didn't have any idea what a jockey did or what a jockey goes through. And so just being able to show that, I'm very proud of with the movie. But then also, you know, I feel like conversations around horse racing kind of fall into one of two camps a lot of times. And it either falls into like, oh, it's amazing and there's nothing wrong, or oh, it's terrible and everything's wrong with it. And the truth is right in the middle. And I think being able to show the beauty of it and the beauty of that lifestyle and not shy away from the warts of it is something that maybe will give us a better understanding and appreciation of it.
Sort of a spoiler alert here, because I have seen the movie, that the star Jackson Silva, the jockey, is kind of down on his luck, over the hill, has been battered by spills. He had numerous injuries. He's fighting off an injury that's affecting his ability to ride. Common sense would say it's time for him to ride off in the sunset. Why can't he do it?
I think that's a great million-dollar question. It's something that I think it's something I ask jockeys a lot, and I think it makes sense of like, this is the thing that has given them, especially if you've been fortunate enough to become an older jockey like Jackson has, it's something that's given you so much meaning in your entire life that it's not just as simple as like, oh, go get another job. It's your life, and to walk away from it's very hard. And G.R. Carter, the great jockey, is actually someone who's become a friend and helped out on the movie. And I was talking to him a little bit about this and asking him about it. And I don't think he dealt with this, but he said a lot of jockeys, you know, everybody knows you're finished before you do. And I think that leads into this character a little bit as well. Jackson is kind of the last to realize that he's not got long left in the sport.
Clint, you kind of touched on this, but Joe and I spend, unfortunately, so much of our time writing about, talking about all that's wrong with horse racing. Yesterday, I wrote the awful story of Medina Spirit.
Yeah.
You mentioned this a little bit, but I'm always curious about how people, you know, and we tend to be within racing circles and don't venture outside of them maybe as much as we should. Obviously, that wouldn't be the case with you. When you tell people you're doing this movie, you said you heard it from both sides, but how often do you hear people say, "Oh my God, why are you doing horse racing? That's so cruel," or "That sport is all fixed," or "All they do is drug all the horses." I was curious about, you know, what, if you could elaborate a little bit on the reaction that you get from people.
Once they see it, they understand it a little better. And you don't really have to have those conversations because they see it and they're like, "Oh yeah." But in the beginning, I just kind of, you know, when I have had those conversations, it's like not sugarcoating that does happen. But the reality is that most of the vast majority of the trainers and the jockeys and the grooms and everybody love those horses and really want to take care of them. And also those people who really want to take care of their horses don't. From what I've experienced and when I've talked to them, they don't have a problem with better regulations and things like that. And upping the weights for jockeys so that you're not having to ride at 124 and you can get up to 128 or 130. Like they're doing very successfully over in France and London and some other places where the jockeys don't get hurt as much and the horses don't get hurt as much. And so I think just giving people that nuance, it is something that they respond to and can understand, like within any sport. But I think it's something that the racing industry itself can do a better job than I can of just by implementing different things that keep people and horses safe.
Well, we thank you for telling this story, Clint. We thank you for coming on and talking with us. Best of luck with the release, man.
Thank you so much. Thank you, guys. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for watching. Yeah.
Careful with them gaps. You're going to clip heels.
It's all right. Dublin hates those outside posts, so. How was he on the turns?
Still soft. Still stutter-stepping into gates like friggin' Fred Astaire.
Yeah, I don't think we're ever going to break him of that.
China Cat's up next.
Yeah, you're going to have a time with him today. He almost kicked at my teeth this morning.
At least he's keeping it interesting. I like him feisty.
Well, he'll have the energy. If you want to get him out first, I think he'll last. Listen, Dublin's owners are here, and she really wants to meet you. Would you just come and say hello?
Ruth.
Come on, man. She's been on my case for like 2 weeks.
Okay.
Just say hi.
All right.
Here he is.
Howdy.
He's got to change right now for
the
next one.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Clint Bentley, will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes. All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. I want to congratulate West Point because last weekend they reached the $60 million milestone in all-time purses. That's a nice chunk of change. The current win total is 968, so they're on pace to hit 1,000 wins as well in 2022. I want to know if you guys know who West Point's all-time leading earner is, Bill or John. Any thoughts?
Stumped. It's hard not to love.
No, this is a good one. This is a good nugget from Katie here. It's Awesome Gem, who earned $2.88 million and was a multiple great stakes winner. Also won the Hollywood Gold Cup in 2010. Now resides at Old Friends in Kentucky. So that just goes to show how many great horses West Point has had. So congratulations to the partners on the milestone and best of luck in 2022. Now we are bringing in our publisher, our boss, Sue Finley, who was in France for the past week. And I don't know if you've heard, but there's a little bit of France drug news going on. So I'm going to let her summarize what's happened in the whirlwind of the past week, and which includes some police raids, which we're well familiar with here in the U.S. Sue, go ahead.
Hey, Joe, thanks so much. So, yeah, so this week in France started out with such really good news in that the Arcana sales company staged their December breeding stock sale, and it broke every record. Top price ever sold at Arcana, international clientele. Peter Brandt came over and spent almost $5 million. Roy and Gretchen Jackson came over and spent money. A new consignment, first year out of the box, topped the sale. Everybody was happy. And then as I was flying home yesterday, the news broke that police had raided the stables of a family in Marseille. They came in and they raided the stables of trainers Frederick, Cedric, and Charlie Rossi. And the reason the two things are connected is that Cedric Rossi, who hasn't yet been arrested trained Rougier, who topped the Arcana sale at $3 million and was sold to Peter Brandt. And he also trained Purple Pay, who Roy and Gretchen Jackson bought for $2 million. Both of those horses are headed to America. And of course, now they're going to have to be subjected to additional tests to determine if they tested positive for anything. And it's just, it's really kind of France's version of the Service Navarro case, because as it turns out, the police have been working on this investigation since last September, and they just staged the raid Tuesday morning at 6:30, just 3 days after these record-breaking sales had happened. They arrested Charlie and his wife, Jessica Marcialis, who's a jockey, and then they brought in Frederick and Cedric for questioning. So all in all, it's just, you know, it's more of the same worldwide. Very disappointing.
I wonder how unprecedented this is in European racing, because it was certainly unprecedented when the FBI came in and busted Service and Navarro and all those people. But I think it was something that we, you know, we expected them to get caught with something along the lines, you know, of drugs sometime. And then we just didn't expect it to the federal law enforcement to get involved. But I wonder if there's ever been any whispers in France or anything about these people and whether or not they're surprised that this happened.
There has been some suspicion and discussion, because the whole family has had, you know, a very sudden run of good fortune. They've been training forever, but the Uncle Frederick just had his first Group One winner last year. They came back, they won races on Arc Day. And so there's definitely been some talk, and there was some reason, obviously, that the police decided to start this inquiry a year ago. You know, and it's just a shame for the buyers who now sort of have purchased these horses who are now under suspicion. It's a shame for the sales company, which was celebrating a justifiable great sale and great performance. It's a shame for the consigners. It's a shame for racing across the world.
And the other question I would have for you is someone who's more plugged into French racing and breeding than I am. You know, and when Service and Navarro happened, there was kind of a cascading effect within the industry that got a lot of people to be like, listen, this is a 5-alarm fire. We got to try to do something about this. And I think that that was kind of the impetus for Heise passing and some of the reforms that we've seen. Do you think that there will be a similar kind of reckoning in France, or do you think this is more of a one-off?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's too early to tell. But the additional similarity is that 15 people were brought in for questioning. And under French law, they can keep them all for 4 days without arresting them. There were veterinarians included. And there are also suggestions reported by the Jour de Gallo, as well as by Emma Berry in our paper, that it's not only doping that's in question, it also may be race fixing. So it's hard to imagine that this isn't going to have some cascading effect throughout the industry.
And Sue, well, you know, you mentioned all the important salient points about not only the breadth of this, the fact that there were 15 people that were brought in, but that it does transcend, you know, I say just blood doping, and goes into possibly race fixing as well, which is, you know, egregious and serious unto itself. How does the sales company react to a situation like this, where, you know, basically they were given the platform to sell these horses, and now there's this, you know, huge cloud that's kind of overseeing this? I know when we buy horses, usually it's yearlings or racehorses, you can actually draw blood and test for certain instances. Would that be the case for these horses as well?
Absolutely. I'm told that the buyers did, just as a routine matter of course, draw blood and test after the sale. Obviously, those tests haven't come back yet. The horses are now being subjected to additional tests, blood, hair, and other things to determine whether or not, you know, they'll test for anything. It's worth mentioning that it's Cedric Rossi who trained Rougier, who sold for $3 million, and Purple Pay, who's and Purple Pay, who sold for 2 million euros. He was not arrested. He did go to the police station. It's unknown if that was voluntarily to provide more evidence, or, you know, if they strongly suggested he come in. So much more to be learned over the coming days.
Sure. And we appreciate you breaking that down for us, Sue. We're glad to have you back from France. You escaped all the turmoil and got back.
Just got out in the nick of time.
And what a great reporter, by not only your spidey senses just made you go to France in ahead of the story. I mean, that's why you're our leader.
It had nothing to do with the wine and cheese at all. Nothing.
Better ear to the street. What's the French thing? Better ear to the rue. Thanks, Sue, for coming on and explaining that story. I think there's going to be a lot of fallout from that as well. So we'll definitely keep you all posted about the French controversy that's going on. But before we wrap up today, I wanted to mention some of the racing. You know, there was racing.
Oh, yeah.
On the past weekend. Yeah, imagine that. It wasn't just horses dying and getting drugged. There was the Cigar Mile Day Card at Aqueduct, which we were all very excited about. And I think, you know, at least the big race didn't disappoint. And it was American Revolution and Following Seed, Ding Dong, battling down the stretch. American Revolution, I was very, very impressed by, simply because I said before the race, I didn't think he wanted to go a mile. I thought that was too short for him. So for him to be able to lay close enough and to be able to wear down Following Seed in the stretch, I thought boded very well for him in the future. And Following Seed ran great. Like, he was not a horse that I liked at all in that race. I don't think he's better going a mile. I think he's better going 6 or 7. You look at the pace, it was 23 and 46, but the way that track was playing, look at where Ginobili finished up the race. And then you can see how well Following Sea ran. So that got me thinking about these three soon to be 4-year-olds that Todd Pletcher has in his barn. Life is Good, American Revolution, and Following Sea. Arguably to me, the three best dirt horses in training, not counting Nick's Go because he's going to be retired after the Pegasus World Cup. Could you find three better dirt horses in training? I don't think so. Following C, I think, will most likely be a sprinter, although, you know, Todd Pletcher talked about having him running the mile next year, which makes sense. But that was just what struck me, is how big both of those horses ran. And with the addition of Life is Good, how loaded Todd Pletcher is going into 2022. What'd you guys think?
And of course, adding to the Pletcher story is he won 3 of the 4 races on Cigar Mile Day, winning the Remsen, the Demoiselle, and then finishing 1-2 in the Cigar Mile. American Revolution, this was a litmus test for him. You know, he had looked very good earlier in his career, but had only beaten New York Breds, had never won any sort of open company stakes. So he goes all the way from a New York Bred race in the Empire Classic into an open grade one. I wasn't as impressed with him, Joe, as apparently you were. And it was an odd performance to me. He was under a stiff drive a half mile out and looked like he wasn't going anywhere. And Luis Saez rode that hair off of that horse and just kept, and I don't know if that's his style. Maybe, you know, he needs to be ridden that way, but, you know, he was never under cruise control by any stretch of the imagination. But having said that, it was a very good win for him and a defining win in his career. And you're right. You know, he is going to go into 2022 as one of the, you know, and again, a million things can change, but, you know, as one of the main contenders, perhaps even for a Horse of the Year title, the sky's the limit for him.
The thing that I loved about this race, guys, is that, you know, we talked about it ahead of time and said this was a quote unquote legitimate grade one. I mean, you look at the names of the horses that are in the race and, you know, starting with the winner, American Revolution, Following Sea, Plainsman, Code of Honor, Ginobili, Independence Hall. I mean, those are all legitimate older horses that all got together and faced off, you know, in the Cigar Mile. So I was really excited to watch the race. I don't think that any of us, you know, ahead of the time thought that American Revolution was the horse to beat, although he definitely went off as the race favorite. But I think that was more of a case because of who he had run against previously compared to the resumes of all the other respective horses in the race. But it did take, as Bill alluded to, it took all of Luis Saez's energies and efforts to get that horse ahead and across the wire in time. And whether or not that the mile is really his best distance is, you know, questionable to say the least. But man, that was a really fun race to watch top to bottom because the lead changed hands a couple of times. There was some tactical race riding amongst the riders. And really, to me, as a race fan, it was a great watching race And it was fun to see a young horse like American Revolution break through, get a grade one and win a big race against Open Company. And Joe, you're right. It looks like that Pletcher is coming into 2022, kind of the way Brad Cox was ending 2021 with just an embarrassment of riches and some really good older horses, heading into the first quarter of the year.
Speaking of Brad Cox, the other graded stakes that Todd Pletcher didn't win on Saturday, Brad Cox won with Lady Rocket, got a 106 buyer, one off crazy. I don't know where that race came from, but she's a late developing type, it seems. And yeah, it's good to have horses to look forward to in 2022 because, you know, there were a lot of retirements and Nick Scow is going to retire after one more race. So it's just one of those things where you lose a lot of horses that you kind of got attached to throughout the season. But to see horses like American Revolution and Following Sea and Life is Good, at least planning to come back as four-year-olds. We'll see. I'm always skeptical that these horses are going to run full four-year-old campaigns, especially after they've won grade ones in American Revolution and Life is Good's case. But yeah, assuming that they actually run in 2022, it's good to have horses like that to look forward to. And next week, we're doing our year in review show. We all pick one horse we're looking forward to most in 2022. And I think those horses will probably be at the top of our list. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Last week, Underhill's Tab was a Legacy grad, later sold for $400,000 as a two-year-old, broke his maiden on debut at Fairgrounds for Spendthrift, and the stats for Legacy grads in 2021, 153 winners of 222 races and 33 black type wins and placings. So Tommy and Wendy obviously do a great job, and the results prove themselves out on the track and in the sales ring. We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
Backstretch workers are the backbone of the thoroughbred racing industry. Without them, racing would not be possible. The New York Racetrack Chaplaincy provides vital programs and services to all the workers and their families, like sponsor a family, the food pantry, as well as other recreational activities and events. You can help by visiting our website and donating today. Every dollar makes a difference to those who give everything to the sport that we love.
It's been an eventful show with a lot of bad news and a lot to wring our hands about, but I'd like to end it on a positive note. Just a little ray of sunshine from your friendly host, Joe Bianca here. The handle numbers came out for November the other day from Equibase, and handle's still going up. So the handle in November was $961 million, which was up 7.4% from last year's figures. It was more flat with November 2019, but overall for the year, handle has now surpassed $11.4 billion, which is a jump of 12.18% over the total through November in 2020 and a 10.49% improvement on the number from the end of 2019, the end of November in 2019. Wagering on U.S. races is likely to top $12 billion by the end of the year. You know the last time that happened? 2009. Betting on horse racing has been steadily going down since the early 2000s. It's been 12 years since it's been $12 billion. We're going to hit that number. And this is a discussion, an ongoing discussion on this show that we talked about. You know, Bill was saying that it was more of the same money just being divvied up differently when the handle numbers were good last year. Well, now we have almost a full year of data with racing being basically back to normal. All of the purses, all the purse levels are basically back to where they were pre-pandemic. So I think it's clear now that we've picked up some new bettors, some new customers along the way. And that's good news. The only caveat is how does racing capitalize on that? How does racing keep that momentum going and maybe even build some more forward momentum? That's a long discussion for another show, but I just wanted to mention those numbers because it is good news that handle has upticked in the last year or two because it has been so long that it was just a steady downward trend. It was like the full crop. It was like the full crop and the handle numbers kept going down. But now we, at least we got a little bit of a bump in handle. Got to give a big shout out to Naira as well for that TV program. And I think there are some people who are doing some good things to bring some new people to the sport and some new bettors to the sport. Most importantly, so we're happy about that. We'll end the show on that note. So with that, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. A reminder that the Keeneland January Horses of All Ages sale is January 10th through the 13th. You can look at the catalog now at January.Keeneland.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Clint Bentley, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next week for our year in review show. Can't wait.